from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson.
The United States strongly condemns the steps that have been taken by Egypt's interim government and security forces. We deplore violence against civilians. We support universal rights essential to human dignity, including the right to peaceful protest.
That was President Obama speaking earlier this morning about the situation in Egypt, where more than 500 people were killed yesterday. In the hour ahead, we'll get the latest on what's happening there and also assess the U.S. response. That's next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson, in today for Michael Krasny. Yesterday in Egypt, the army crushed protester encampments with deadly precision, and the death toll there has now risen to over 500. Earlier this morning, President Obama offered this assessment.
We've sustained our commitment to Egypt and its people. But while we want to sustain our relationship with Egypt, our traditional cooperation cannot continue as usual when civilians are being killed in the streets and rights are being rolled back. As a result, this morning we notified the Egyptian government that we are canceling our biannual joint military exercise, which was scheduled for next month. Going forward, I've asked my national security team to assess the implications of the actions taken by the interim government and further steps that we may take as necessary with respect to the U.S.-Egyptian relationship.
President Obama speaking earlier this morning. And today on Forum, we're going to take up where things stand now in Egypt, as well as assess the U.S. response. Joining us to do that, Amy Hawthorne. She's senior fellow at the Atlantic Council's Rafik Hariri Center for the Middle East. She joins us this morning from Washington. Amy, good morning.
Good morning.
Joining us, too, is Joel Bainan. He's professor of history and professor of Middle East history in particular at Stanford University, also the former director of Middle East Studies and professor of history at the American University in Cairo. Professor Bainan, thanks for joining us as well.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning to both. Let's begin with your assessment of what the president did this morning. Amy Hawthorne, is it what you expected, and is it the correct response in your judgment?
It is what I expected, in the sense that this White House has been very cautious about taking bold steps to change the traditional U.S. relationship with Egypt, as we've seen most dramatically in the administration's non-response to the coup of July 3rd, its announcement that it was deciding not to make a decision about whether or not it was a coup and thereby suspending aid according to U.S. law. So this was a rather cautious response. I do think, though, that under the circumstances in Egypt, and according to the president's own past rhetoric, that a stronger response definitely would have been merited.
And do you expect that stronger response might still be in the offing? The last part of the president's statement that we played implied that those things are under review.
Yes, I think it's possible. It seems to me that what the United States, what the administration is trying to do is avoid taking a really bold step, such as suspending aid or taking other really strong measures, until it feels that really it's at the point of no return and that those kinds of steps would be absolutely critical. There's a couple of details in the president's statement that signaled to me that it might be positioning itself or preparing itself for a stronger response. For example, it mentioned, as you pointed out, the desire of the president to review U.S. assistance and our posture toward Egypt, which is sort of a subtle way of putting the Egyptian government on notice. It was also interesting, I thought, that President Obama mentioned in his statement that there was a military intervention in Egypt. He didn't use the word coup, but he did use the term military intervention, which I think is stronger and more sort of direct language than the administration has used before to describe what happened on July 3rd. So this, to me, suggests that the administration might be thinking about a stronger response, but it doesn't want to use that response at this time, which I think is regrettable. It's a terrible situation in Egypt, The Egyptian government, the military, the security forces have basically done exactly what President Obama and Secretary Kerry were calling on them not to do. And so it's hard to see if the situation that's unfolding now doesn't merit a stronger response from the United States, you know, what would?
Amy Hawthorne, Senior Fellow at the Atlantic Council Center for the Middle East. Joel Bannon at Stanford, would you place that within the same continuum as Amy Hawthorne does, that this is sort of par for the course in terms of how the administration has responded to things to date?
It's par for the course in the sense that from the beginning of the demonstrations against former President Mubarak, the administration of President Obama has trailed behind events. In part, that's because it hasn't had a very good understanding of what's going on, but it's also in part due to the fact that the actual influence that the United States can exercise is quite limited. Short of cutting all military aid, no other measure would have much of an impact on the army, which is now and has been the real force controlling the country.
Why is it that there isn't more leverage, given the long and historic relationship between the two countries? Help us understand why more arm twisting hasn't been effective today.
The principal reason for that is that the relationship isn't between the two countries. The relationship is between the Obama administration and before it, previous American administrations, and the Egyptian army, first and foremost. We can't forget, the Egyptian people certainly aren't going to forget, that for nearly 30 years of President Mubarak's regime, the United States had a very close relationship with an authoritarian government whose foreign policy, especially regarding the Arab-Israeli conflict, was out of sync with the sentiments of the vast majority of the Egyptian people. It pursued highly repressive domestic policies. It was not a popular regime. The United States, from time to time, expressed some reservations about those things, but it never did anything of real substance, nor really was it in a position to, as long as the view in Washington was, and as it still is, that the overall geostrategic position of the United States in the Middle East, it depends on having a stable pro-American regime in Egypt.
Joel Bannon, professor of history at Stanford University. We're joined as well now by Shadi Hamid. He's director of research at the Brookings Doha Center, also fellow at the Sabin Center for Middle East Policy. He joins us from Doha, Qatar this morning. Shadi Hamid, would you concur with what Joel Bannon just said, that in the end, what trumps here is how the United States views its strategic interests? And so that's the reason why we have not taken a more aggressive stance?
I would disagree a little bit. I don't think it's in U.S. strategic interest to have a military that is killing its own people and pushing Egypt into real civil conflict. I mean, we're going to have a spiraling of violence here, and we've already seen signs of that, not to mention a low-level insurgency in Sinai. So this is very much not in American strategic interest at all. So even if you're limiting yourself just to the stability argument and pushing aside morality, this does not lead to a stable Egypt. As for what the U.S. can do, it can, in fact, if it wants to, suspend aid. And if the U.S. was serious and if the Obama administration was more interested in a proactive approach, that is a real policy option. And there were several points where the U.S. could have at least made the credible threat. So even if we don't want to suspend aid immediately, at least being clear about what conditions would trigger an aid suspension. So, for example, if certain minimal democratic standards aren't met, or if massacres continue, and to just be very clear about what governs this bilateral relationship.
And what are the risks of our doing that? I mean, from your standpoint, Shadi, I mean, obviously that would be the action that you'd like to see the Obama administration take. But where could that go off the rails? What could be the negative consequence of suspending aid?
I think the Obama administration would argue then that if we did suspend aid, we'd lose leverage with the Egyptian military. They wouldn't listen to us and so on. But it's clear they're not really listening to us anyway. I mean, what more can you do besides staging a military coup against the democratically elected president, having not one massacre, but three? There were already two last month, and having one of the single highest death tolls in modern Egyptian history, which we saw yesterday. I mean, there's not a whole lot more the military can do. You know, at some point you have to establish where the red line is. Unfortunately, this is an administration that does not take the idea of red line seriously. And, you know, threats have to be credible. If the Egyptian military knows that we're never going to follow up on our threat to suspend aid, then they have nothing to worry about.
And Joel Bainan, describe why you think it is the administration has been historically, over the course of the administration, so reluctant to take vigorous action. What's behind that reluctance, and what would they argue, I guess, is the reason to proceed so cautiously?
Well, one of the main elements of the American geostrategic position in the Middle East is preserving the security of Israel. Both the Mubarak regime and the regime of former Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi and whatever military-backed regime will be in power now are all committed to maintaining the Egyptian-Israeli peace treaty. And from the point of view of Washington, that is one of the most important contributions of Egypt to the overall American position in the Middle East. That treaty, and if not the treaty itself, certain elements of it are not very popular among the Egyptian people. So to the extent that Egyptian foreign policy were conducted on lines that were consistent with the wishes of the Egyptian people, it might not guarantee the security of Israel, and it might not protect that interest of the United States. So the United States is forced to balance two completely contradictory elements. On the one hand, having an Egyptian government carry out a foreign policy which is not particularly popular domestically, and on the other hand, it would certainly prefer to have a democratic, stable Egypt with a government that does not abuse the human rights and lives of its population. But stability is going to trump democracy. It always has, not only in Egypt and the Middle East, but in American foreign policy throughout the world.
Hmm. Amy Hawthorne, let's turn to the situation in Egypt now. Is the Arab Spring done and gone? Is democracy, in a sense, done and gone? How bleakly do you assess the situation right now in that country?
Unfortunately, I look at the situation very, very bleakly. I don't believe that Egypt is embarked on a democratic transition right now. I actually don't believe that Egypt was embarked on a democratic transition under the presidency of Mohamed Morsi, nor was it embarked on a democratic transition under the previous period of military rule after President Mubarak left. I think that the key elements of the Egyptian state that existed under Mubarak, under Sadat, even in some cases under Nasser, that are authoritarian in nature, continue to exist. There has been some liberalization of the political sphere with greater freedom of expression, rights of assembly, ability to demonstrate, much greater popular mobilization and popular pressure on the Egyptian leadership. But the key elements that constituted the previous regime, the system, is still intact. This does not mean, in my view, that Egypt can never democratize or that a democratic transition is an impossible goal. Indeed, we've seen many, many examples around the world of all different kinds of countries that have made a successful transition from an authoritarian system, a military-dominated authoritarian system, to a democracy. So it is by no means impossible, and there's nothing inherent in Egyptian society or history or culture, in my view, that makes democracy impossible. But I think one of the problems, in my view, with the administration's approach to Egypt for some time now is that we've basically been looking at the country, or the administration has been looking at the country as engaged in a democratic transition that has been bumpy and rocky, and at some points Egypt has kind of fallen off the rails, and then we and other countries have tried to help it get back on, but that really it's kind of proceeding on this trajectory. And I just don't think that that is an accurate assessment of where Egypt stands right now, and I think that the U.S. would be better served by looking at kind of the reality of Egyptian politics and then formulating a policy based on that reality, not on what we wish it would be. And as I said, this doesn't mean declaring that Egypt can't be a democracy. I would think we and other countries should hold that out as a goal and echo the demands and the hopes of many, many Egyptians, but I just don't see the situation in Egypt, especially now, as constituting anything that could lead to a stable democratic system, unfortunately.
Shadi Hameen, do you feel then that in the current situation, even though, as Amy Hawthorne suggests, there's nothing to indicate that a democratic process isn't possible at some time, but for now at least, anything that would happen, let's say another election is called, it's sort of called but can always be trumped by the military. It's like saying, we can have an election, but it only counts if it goes the way we want it to. Is that how you see this?
Yeah, so even if you do have democratic elections in the coming year, the competition is going to be constrained. And I think importantly, the largest opposition group in the country is probably not going to participate, and that, of course, is the Muslim Brotherhood. So you can't really have a real inclusive democracy if the largest opposition group is not permitted to participate. And I think that's very clearly where we're going. And also, we have to consider that, let's say there is, an elected president who does have his own ideas and he stands in the way of the military's interests. The precedent of military intervention in Egyptian politics has been set. The role has been legitimated. And that's very difficult to undo. And that's why, at least under President Morsi, as bad as he was ineffective, incompetent. I think we're all in agreement about that. At least there was a democratic process in place where people could compete, and there were mechanisms for disagreeing with one each other through the electoral process. There were parliamentary elections coming up, so on and so forth. So there was at least a possibility of a positive trajectory in at least the medium term. There isn't any of that now, and it's very difficult to envision how you get the military out of everyday politics at this point. You know, it took Turkey 48 years after its first military coup against a democratically elected leader.
Joel Bainan, how significant is the resignation of Mohamed al-Baradei, and is there anyone else out there who could have the stature to mount a credible response to the military?
It's very significant at one level and of no importance whatsoever at another. It is significant because he is a figure with international credibility. I don't think there's any doubt that he is sincerely a democratic personality, a liberal personality. I think he made an egregious judgment of political reality, because I agree very much with what Amy Hawthorne has said. There was not a credible transition to democracy at any point since Mubarak was removed. And he believed, along with a good many others in the Tamarud, or rebel movement that called for the demonstrations past June 30th that ultimately ended in Morsi's ouster, he believed that the army was going to carry out the democratic will of the people, just as many Egyptians believed when the army pushed Mubarak aside in February of 2011, that the army was going to carry out the democratic will of the Egyptian people. But the army leadership had no such agenda in mind. Its agenda was, first and foremost, to maintain its own privileges and immunities, and those were guaranteed in the constitution adopted last December, and secondly, to maintain political stability, including the alliance with the United States. So al-Baradei completely misjudged who the army is, what they want to do, and who conceivable democratic allies could be in Egypt. I think both in the United States and in Egypt, and I agree again with Amy Hawthorne on this, there's been considerable illusion about how a democratic transition takes place. You don't get a democratic transition from an autocratic regime by simply removing the head of state, Hosni Mubarak, in the case of Egypt. Neither would you get one by removing former President Mohamed Morsi, who on the one hand was democratically elected and on the other hand ruled with complete abuse of rights and guarantees for any elements of the Egyptian population that didn't agree with the Muslim Brothers. Democratic transition comes from a popular mass movement from below, not from above. That's what happened with the first democracy in modern history, the constitutional monarchy in England, which the entire 17th century was full of violence and upheaval and so on. That's what happened in the United States, not only in the Revolutionary War, but also in the movement against slavery, the abolitionist movement, which ultimately resulted in the Civil War and the Emancipation Proclamation and so on. So democratic transitions take place over the course of decades and generations. It's not something that happens in a one-time moment.
Right. So I guess I hear you all saying that it's possible but extraordinarily difficult. And Amy Hawthorne, I guess I'd like a clue as to how we get there from here. If there hasn't been this tradition of democracy, if it is indeed a long, difficult process, outline the way forward. You said earlier that there was nothing within Egypt's history or culture that means that it can't happen. I'm wondering how it can.
Well, democratic transitions, democratization processes, indeed, you know, democracies themselves as they function are incredibly diverse, but there's a few core elements that would need to happen in Egypt. Let me just mention a few, and maybe my colleagues can join in with some other thoughts. First of all, I mean, let me just say at the outset that democracy is not the opposite of authoritarian regime. It's a conscious choice. It's a conscious decision to create a certain kind of political system that has certain elements. So it has to be built. It doesn't just unfold. One of the things that's very important that we've seen in a lot of other successful transitions is that the people who were responsible for the worst abuses and human rights violations and undemocratic actions under the previous regime, in this case under Mubarak, if they are not prosecuted and held accountable for their crimes, at a minimum, then they are discredited, shamed, and basically ostracized from the political sphere. One of the most troubling things that's happened in Egypt in the recent troubling weeks has been the return to positions of authority, positions of power, of some of the most feared state security agents and governors who served under the former regime. These people, are serving now with impunity. They're back in positions of power. They have a lot of influence. This is a very disturbing sign. So one thing that would need to happen is that people who were responsible for a lot of bad things under the previous regime would need to basically be ostracized, if not held accountable.
Let me hold you there, if I might, before you get to your second ingredient, because we have to take a short break. And so when we return, Amy Hawthorne, we'll hear your other points. I want to hear from the rest of our guests as well about how we get there from here and what might be possible and what the role of the United States could be in encouraging that process. If you have questions about what's going on in Egypt, thoughts on what the United States ought to do, we'd like to have you join our conversation. You can do so at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org or post your thoughts or questions on our Facebook page or on our website. We'll be back with more in just a moment. This is Forum on KQED. I'm Dave Iverson. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson, in today for Michael Krasny. Our topic this hour, the situation in Egypt and the United States' response to it. We're about a half hour away from curfew in Cairo at this time, and the AP is reporting that the military government in Egypt has now authorized police to use deadly force to protect police and key institutions from attacks. There were, according to the Egyptian government, some 40 policemen who were killed yesterday, along with the over 500 killed in the encampments. We take up this topic now with Amy Hawthorne at the Atlantic Council Center for the Middle East, Shadi Hamid at the Brookings Doha Center, Joel Bainan, professor of history at Stanford University, and in a moment we'll also hear from Adele Iskandar at Georgetown University. Before the break, Amy Hawthorne, you were outlining how we get to a more democratic situation in Egypt, and you were saying your first point was that people who have behaved badly cannot continue to hold power with impunity. Go ahead and build your checklist of a point or two more, and then we'll get some other viewpoints on this.
Sure. Just briefly, a second key element of at least the beginning of a democratic transition is that there needs to be a decision among all of the key political players, the key factions, the key political stakeholders in the country to agree basically on the rules of the game. What is this political system going to look like? Under what newly democratic rules are we going to operate? What is the basis for political participation? What are the standards? In some countries, this has been called a national pact. It could be called a consensus. It's some kind of foundational activity that brings together the key stakeholders in politics, not just in government, from across the political spectrum to agree on what the political system is going to look like. What are the rules going to be? This is even before a constitution is made. This never happened in Egypt since Mubarak left. First, essentially, the military that was running the country after Mubarak was deposed more or less made a deal with the Islamists, with the Muslim Brotherhood in particular, an informal deal about how the system would work, excluding other political forces, which were unable to participate in that. And now we see, broadly speaking, several years later, a political deal essentially between the military, the old regime, let's call it, the old state, the deep state, and secular non-Islamist forces, excluding a lot of key Islamist forces from that. So until that really happens, until there can be some kind of broad, imperfect but broad national consensus about what the new political system is going to look like, what the terms of participation are going to be, it's very, very hard for a country to make a democratic transition.
Let's keep building our checklist, and then we'll go to our calls on the kinds of steps that have to happen for Egypt to begin a transition, since you all agree that that transition hasn't even started yet, to a democratic society. Adele Iskandar joins us as well. He is a media scholar at Georgetown University. His new book is called Egypt in Flux, Essays on an Unfinished Revolution. Adele Iskandar, thanks for joining us as well.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate
and
it.
Add, if you would, to what Amy Hawthorne was saying about what has to happen if we're ever going to get to a democratic state in Egypt.
Well, I mean, I think some of the basic principles have to be in place. I think the problem that we're facing today is generally a lack of consensus on whether or not democratic principles have actually become enshrined. Most of the Muslim Brotherhood supporters, as well as the Islamist camp that are very much entrenched in one perspective, believe that the democratic transition has already accomplished specific goals, and not just looking at their ability to secure electoral victories through the ballot box, but more importantly, the fact that there was a constitution that went through a sort of a draft process as well as a public referendum. So they're completely convinced that the transition has begun to bear fruit. So anything that doesn't acknowledge what has been accomplished in their eyes over the past 2 years is flawed by default, and actually takes us back to square one. That, of course, is not a vision shared by most other political players in the Egyptian scene now. Of course, the military has its own interests as well as other significant institutions, the deep state, et cetera, et cetera. But other political players in Egypt, or political parties specifically, they don't see eye to eye with this, and they believe that they've been extricated or marginalized from the political process, that the ground rules were not established beforehand.
Right.
And that the pact between the military and the Muslim Brotherhood, or the Islamist camp by and large, effectively kept them outside of the outside of the negotiating table. Whether or not the two groups see eye to eye on this is really, really quite critical. So I think the beginning of the end of this was really the military's intervention in the political process in a manner that was deemed, advantageous and beneficial for the Islamists a good 2 years ago.
And these don't sound like things, Joel Bainan, that the United States can do very much about. I mean, almost by definition, these are internal processes and conversations and trajectories that have to take place within the country itself. So with all these things that Adel Iskander and Amy Hawthorne have said have to happen, do you see a way that the United States can encourage that process?
No, you're right. There is not very much the United States could or should do, in my opinion, because as President Obama said this morning in his statement, both of the two main political blocs, the Muslim Brothers and their opponents, believe that over the past 2.5 years, the United States has sided with the other group, whereas, in fact, I think the United States, as Amy has said, has been very cautious and unwilling to take a decisive stand one way or the other. Democracy can't be imported or imposed from abroad. The United States has less leverage now over Egypt than it had under Mubarak, so the options are very limited, and the United States is going to have to, by and large, stand by and hope for the best, saying good words, as both Secretary of State Kerry and President Obama did this morning. Can help marginally, but those things aren't in the end going to prove decisive.
We're going to go to our calls in just a moment, but very briefly, Shadi Hamid, would suspending aid, would cutting off aid, as I know many of you feel, would be appropriate, but would it do anything to make democracy flourish?
Well, first of all, it's just worth saying that there was, in fact, a democratic transition. It was very flawed. There were problems, and my colleagues on this program have laid some of those out, but there was actually a transitional process. The problem is that there was a military coup on July 4th, which ended that process and actually pushed Egypt in the exact opposite direction. So I think we should just be, clear about that. As for what the U.S., if the U.S. did decide to suspend aid, there's no way to know for sure what kind of effect it would have. I think that should have happened a month ago, right when the military coup happened and the U.S. was under a legal obligation to do so. And that could have set an important precedent and sent a strong message to the military. But I think to even have these conversations now is in some sense moot. We're well beyond this. It's not about democracy anymore. It's about averting not just civil conflict, but even possibly civil war. So, I think we're so far away from any real discussion of democratization.
Yeah.
Now it's about making sure that Egypt doesn't become an utterly failed state.
Well, let's hear more about what's going on in Egypt right now. And we're joined first by Ben, who is calling us from Cairo. Ben, tell us what you're doing there and what you are seeing in Cairo this evening.
Oh, thank you. Well, I'm just back into my apartment, and I'm going to adhere to, curfew. So I think that on the streets there's kind of a sense of normalcy in the way where I live. I live in Maidi, which is a very affluent expat area within Cairo. Banks are closed. There's no way to wire any money out. There's some things like this. You do see on the Corniche, on the Nile, they were patrolling up there. But I think for the most part, people feel that within a week, things will calm back down.
And is it your sense, Ben, that there is not greater danger of civilian casualties, that the protests are now going to be muted to such a degree that there will not be more death on the streets of Cairo?
It's just a shock. I mean, seeing all of that violence and seeing the death from the media. I mean, Egyptians, the friends that I have here, just, they're hurt. They cannot believe that they're so sad that this happened. And, things can be chaotic and crazy in Cairo already alone, but I think that they feel, it will, this Friday night, you know, they will go to mosque and afterwards will riot or will go to do their rallies again. And people are very anxious. There's a sense of tension to see what's going to happen this coming Friday evening. And I think they feel that it will work its way out, that hopefully that's a positive, optimistic sense that maybe within, like I said, a week, they feel things will try to calm down.
Yeah, Ben, thanks for the call and for your impressions of how things are faring there now. Adele Iskander, as someone who's born in Egypt, I'm wondering about your sense about that and your sense of whether or not further protests, the Brotherhood has been saying we're going to keep fighting back. Do you think that will happen, or do you think that because of the extreme military response yesterday, that by brute force, protests will diminish?
Well, okay, just a quick correction. I wasn't actually born in Egypt. I am born to Egyptian parents, but
I see. Sorry.
In Egypt, but so that's okay. I think to a large extent, the real question is whether or not the Muslim Brotherhood as an organization can continue sort of to hold rank and file all of its supporters at this point. I mean, there's a tremendous amount of anger within the Brotherhood and the Brotherhood supporters and supporters of Morsi. And, of course, the cataclysm that is the last 24 hours is going to be a very tough pill to swallow. And so the demonstrations today and also yesterday and attacks against churches and police stations and various other things. I mean, it is essentially a volcanic eruption of anger and chants in the streets against the term Selmiya, which is peaceful. People saying Selmiya Metet, peacefulness has died. This is a very ominous, turning point that may be very difficult to control beyond the immediate reach of the leadership of the Muslim Brotherhood. So I think things are looking very, very dangerous. The key here is for the top-ranking members of the Muslim Brotherhood to effectively bring things back from the brink, essentially, and for the military and the security forces to begin to acknowledge the fact that there was a disaster that they actively participated in, that they were responsible for the deaths of hundreds of supporters, not all of whom the majority of whom are peaceful, and that there needs to be a reform of the Ministry of Interior and the security apparatus, and that this is not going to go away. But anything short of essentially pushing down the brakes as hard as you possibly can is going to be very, very difficult. And what I'm most concerned about are the fringe elements on both sides. I mean, the Egyptian political scene is so polarized that the far ends of the spectrum are either calling for the complete extermination of the Muslim Brotherhood or conversely, on the other side, a full-fledged battle against the institutions of the state.
Yeah, it gives polarization an entirely different and more acute and more dangerous meaning. Adele Iskander at Georgetown University. Let's hear from more of our listeners this morning. Ede in Berkeley joins us next. Ede, go ahead.
Hi, good morning. Unlike Adele, I was born in Egypt. I was aware of the Brotherhood since I was young, very young child, and I hated them, so as my family, so everybody in our neighborhood. The fact is, I put most of the blame on the Brotherhood. I think that they, instead of doing what is good for Egypt, they want what's good for the Brotherhood, and two, Islamize Egypt as distorted version of Islam. They have no interest whatsoever for the group of people. Their whole agenda will be evolved around how women dress, or whether people go to prayer, and how to treat minority. And I think cutting the aid also is not good for the sake of Egyptian. The army people did very well. So if you cut the aid, you're only going to hurt the Egyptians. And I hear a lot of comment from your guest what the Egyptians want. And also remember, Morsi only won by only 11%, or 22% people voted because everybody sit home because there's a choice between him and some guy from Mubarak government. So he really did not at all represent the majority of Egyptians.
Ede, I'm going to hold you there. I appreciate the point because it gets us to something we should cover. And Amy Hawthorne, let me ask you to do that about the role and responsibility of the Brotherhood in all of this. We're discussing to some extent so far what the army has done, but what about the role of the Brotherhood and whether or not it, to what degree does it also share in responsibility for how things have come undone?
Well, first I would just say that the sentiments that the caller was expressing toward the Brotherhood and about the situation in Egypt, I think, are very similar to those that a lot of people I know in Egypt are expressing. So they're not, they're certainly widespread views at this moment in terms of understanding the political mood, the political atmosphere in Egypt. Yes, I think responsibility does lie with the Brotherhood for many, many things. There were many, many, many mistakes made under the Morsi government, not just incompetence, but willful mistakes that violated President Morsi's promises to the Egyptian people and violated, I think, the demands of the Egyptian revolution. And there are many things, in my view, that the Brotherhood would need to do to change and adjust to be able to be a constructive player in a potential hypothetical future democratic process in Egypt. That being said, I don't think that we should equate what has happened with the Brotherhood to the actions that the Egyptian state has taken. The two parties are not equal in power, and right now, in my view, the onus is really on the Egyptian state in terms of setting the tone, setting the agenda, setting the actions that are going to shape the country going forward. But I do want to underscore the Brotherhood. While Morsi was in power before that and in these last 6 weeks, there have been many, many, many troubling, intolerant, and other disturbing actions that they've taken that really run counter to democratic values, in my view.
And Shadi Hamid, is that your view as well, that they were a seriously flawed movement, but still in the end, they were who was elected, and that trumps whatever flaws they had?
It doesn't necessarily trump the flaws that they had, but you can't have democracy. You know, a lot of Egyptians and critics of the Brotherhood are making the point that democracy isn't just about the ballot box. Yeah, that's obviously true, but you can't have democracy without the ballot box. That is one of the fundamental components. And that's why the military coup was so dangerous, because it essentially disregarded the previous five elections in Egypt and said those votes don't matter. So whatever we want to say about the Brotherhood, they were elected in successive elections to power. So no matter how bad Morsi was, that has no bearing on whether a military coup was justified. Military coups against elected leaders are not okay, regardless of how bad those leaders are, period.
Some comments coming in on our email service. Robert writes, from what perch do Americans or their government give advice to other countries about how their democratic process should work? What chutzpah? Jim writes, this discussion is so out of context. For example, you're talking about the U.S. cutting off aid to Egypt as being somehow meaningful, when it's clearly not. The aid we give is basically just tanks and military aircraft that Egypt doesn't need. They already have more than they can use, so much that they're leaving them some of it crated. So cutting off aid will not help. And another listener writes, can someone address the likelihood that Egypt's military received assurances from Washington before ousting Morsi? It seems reasonable to me that they would check with their biggest backer before making such a move. Any thoughts on that, Joel Bannon?
I don't think those are important questions, and I don't think we can know the answers to them quite yet. Talal Assad wrote just a short while ago of a meeting between Mohamed al-Baradei and Ahmed Shafiq, who was former President Morsi's opponent in the second round of the Egyptian presidential elections and the candidate basically of the army and the old regime, that Baradei and Shafiq had met in Saudi Arabia a month before June 30th. And if that was the case, then the army must have known about that. So there may have been, we don't know for sure, a certain amount of coordination between the civilian political forces that called for the demonstrations on June 30th that ultimately led to the military ouster of Morsi on July 3rd. Exactly how much coordination and how much detail, we don't know. I agree with those who have said that the Muslim Brothers made very egregious mistakes and, in fact, committed crimes while President Morsi was in office. At first, the brothers tried to form a coalition with the army and with the institutions of the old regime that remained in their place after Mubarak's ouster. They were perfectly willing to go along with the deep state, countenanced the police and the army firing on and killing and wounding peaceful demonstrators. And at a certain point, the army decided, no, they don't think that that's a stable alliance, and they're going to switch horses. And then came all the so-called liberals and secularists and leftists and so on, and now they are in an alliance with the army. So it's very hard to find any good guys here. And among many other reasons, that's a reason why the United States shouldn't and can't do much to influence the course of events. My view is not quite as pessimistic as Amy Hawthorne's. I think for the short and medium run, there's not very good chance for real development of democracy in Egypt. But something very important happened in January, February of 2011, and that is that the Egyptian people found their political voice for the first time in six decades. And that lesson can't easily be undone. Two presidents have been removed as a result of popular action. We could have a big debate about how democratic any of that was, but Egyptian people now understand that if they mobilize themselves, they can achieve some political results.
Yeah, interesting. Interesting observation that there may still be that lesson reverberating in the country. Let's hear from more of our listeners, though. John in Oakland joins us next. John, go ahead.
Yes, I'd like to actually redirect our conversation, if I might, to a bit more of critical analysis. I mean, this is really giving a free pass and a shoulder up to the U.S. administration. I mean, this policy of nothing, as admitted by several guests in different ways, it has blown up in our faces. You want to talk about Israeli security? They just got to try out their Iron Dome for the first time in southern Israel from rockets that were fired from the Sinai in Egypt. It's not secure. In addition to that, I mean, I want you to take a look at about 5-10 years as to where this violence is leading and think about how secure this, you know, the Suez Canal and our energy corridor is going to be. It won't. I mean, I want to talk about some missed opportunities on the part of the administration. This is a great case study for state foreign policy and the failures there. And, I mean, we gave them this military aid just before the coup happened. We had a whole 6 months to get congressional approval to not call this a coup or to still send them aid, and or to pick up the red phone and say, hey, we're going to take some bellicose rhetoric and stances, you know, sticking up for democracy, but check this out. Don't worry about it. 6-8 months, we'll figure this out and get you guys your money. Let's try and play nice.
John, thanks for the observation, though I would say that many of our guests this morning have echoed much of what you say, that that there have been missed opportunities and perhaps too much caution on the basis of the Obama administration. But thanks for adding your voice as well. Let's hear next from San Jose and Mark. Mark, go ahead.
Hi. I wanted to just point out a couple of things, actually.
Hey Mark, we're gonna have to let you go. Your phone is breaking up. Call back if you would, if you can, on a different line, and we'll try to get your viewpoint in. But thanks for trying to get in. Try once more if you would. Bob in Mountain View is next. Bob, go ahead.
Hi, I'm optimistic too, but this was entirely predictable. The Mubarak regime wanted to get a constitution right, and the Tahrir protesters, all the protesters, said, "No, you out." And then the junta wanted to get the constitution right, and they said, no, you out. And they moved up the date as to when the presidential elections would occur and when the constitution would be approved. And guess who got to finish off the constitution? The Islamic Brotherhood. The Mubarak regime knew that there is an underclass, certain amount, and there's a strong presence of the Muslim Brotherhood. They wanted to get a balance. Now, the balance will get right probably now, but there is people, and it goes to show that there's a lot of intelligence there that wanted to get it right, and this is maybe the rocky road to get to where they should have gotten, but it looks like that they're going to get there, and this is the kind of road they had to take to get there. It's unfortunate, but I believe the Mubarak regime and the vice president under him, that they said that, where they said you out, and that the junta that wanted to get it right should be credited, because they saw what the kids were going to grab and what they were going to get burned with. And
Okay, Bob, I'm gonna hold you there because we're short on time. But you have certainly given the most optimistic assessment possible, I think, of what has taken place in Egypt to date. We want to get a final quick assessment from each of our guests. I'm sorry to say, just 20 seconds or so each, starting with Shadi Hamid.
Yeah, it would be one thing if this was just a return to the Mubarak era, but we're actually going to see the return of something worse. By any conceivable standard, Egypt today is more repressive than it's been in recent memory. So I just think that perspective is important to keep in mind here, that, you know, the movement is in the opposite direction.
Yeah. Amy Hawthorne.
Sure. I think with respect to the United States, the Obama administration is trying to balance two sets of interests, security and foreign policy interests, and what I believe is actually a very sincere interest in seeing democratization unfold in Egypt. The problem is that to take a strong step on the second goal, the administration believes would hurt the first goal. And so I think the United States' role will continue to be weakened by its desire not to take a strong stand on behalf of democracy. But going forward, it's going to be very difficult, in my view, for the United States to continue to be very closely associated with the regime, with the government in Egypt that is carrying out these kinds of actions against its own citizens.
Adel Iskander, I'm sorry, just a brief last thought, please.
I'm most concerned about the escalation of violence, not just starting in the last couple of days, but actually over the past couple of years. That this has been a steady development in the direction of more violence and is becoming more and more an acculturated part of society. And that worries me more than anything else.
And Joel Bainan.
I want to reiterate my long-term optimism. I agree with those who have said that the existing political institutions in Egypt are undemocratic and that the current trajectory is a very bad one. On the other hand, I think that the transition to democracy has to be seen as a long-term historical process, which has barely begun.
Joel Bainan at Stanford University. Thanks to all of our guests for adding your perspective on this difficult, complicated, and very much in flux situation. Appreciate you all being part of our program. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Tina Lorberg. Our engineer today, Danny Bringer. Dan Zoll is our senior editor. Raul Ramirez, our executive producer. And Amanda Supai, our engagement producer. I'm Dave Iverson, in for Michael Krasny today. This is Forum on KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.